When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From Variety, celebrating more than 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
But I felt like having a part of that control could contribute to you know, telling the story in a thoughtful way. And luckily, everyone on the entire team, we all felt the same in how we wanted to bring sensitivity to this and also kind of show the story from an unbiased approach.
Elle Fanning wasn't so sure at first whether she wanted to star in The Girl from Plainville, given the scandalous nature of how the case at the center of the series was portrayed by the press. But then she dove in deeper. I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast, we talk to The Girl from Plainville and the great star and executive producer Elle Fanning about the two very different Hulu shows. After that, we chat with Pachinko creator and showrunner Sue Hugh about her remarkable Apple TV Plus show. It's all next on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close. Elle Fanning has grown up on screen, starring in dozens of movies since her film debut 2 decades ago. Starting in 2020, she's gained acclaim as Empress Catherine II in the Hulu comedy The Great. But 2 weeks after wrapping production on season 3, she dove into a much more serious project, Hulu's The Girl from Plainville, playing another real person, Michelle Carter, the teen who was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging her boyfriend, Conrad Roy III, to end his life.
Michelle, what is it?
Conrad's dead.
Who's Conrad?
Leading up to his suicide, there are text exchanges between the two of them. Thousands of them.
What motive could she possibly have for telling him to kill himself?
We don't get it.
This is our love story.
Though The Great was nominated for 2 Emmys, one writing and one directing in 2020, Fanning has yet to be recognized for her role of Catherine the Great. Her co-star, Nicholas Hoult, has also been looked over in past years. But Fanning is Hulu's shining star this year, with both The Great and The Girl from Plainville in the Emmy conversation. Not only does she lead the comedy and the dark drama, she also serves as an executive producer on both. Variety's Emily Longaretta and I sat down with Elle Fanning to talk about both projects, but particularly what went into playing Michelle Carter on The Girl from Plainville. We began by noting how she is indeed Hulu's MVP of the year.
Yeah, Hulu all the way. Like, you know, it's so funny because someone was talking the other day, like one of my friends saying, because Hulu, the Instagram Hulu, you know, comments on my, like all my Instagram photos all the time. And it's like always a boost from Hulu. They're like, yes, queen, like you're doing great. I'm like, thanks, Hulu. It's like, I'm like, whoever's running that. I'm like, they're giving me a boost in the morning. Wow. I know when I check my comments.
I like Hulu is like self-affirmation totally. For Elle Fanning. That's yes. Great.
Yeah.
Everyone needs a little of that in their life.
Let's I know.
Have,
I
everyone
know.
Have those
it's
accounts.
So funny.
They're not like, get back to work. Like,
no, seriously. Yeah, exactly.
We're season 3 of The Great.
Exactly.
Stop posting.
Well, they're kind of, yeah, well, I mean, we're about to go shoot the 3rd season in like a matter of weeks. Yeah, I'm going back to London soon, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. It's like, Tony McNamara, who is our showrunner, and he writes The Great. He kind of writes as he goes along. So he has like kind of an overview of what he wants the whole season to look like. But I've only read the first script of season 3, and I'm sure it will change, but he's ever evolving. So you never really know what to expect with Tony. We're always on our toes. And we have like an initial table read before each block. And sometimes none of us will have read like any of the last episodes. Like at the table read, we find out, you know, what happens and like, we're like, oh my God, he's very secretive, Tony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you fine with that or
are you dying to learn more and what's in his head and where things are going with Catherine?
You know, I think like the audience member in me is dying to know what's next. But then I kind of works. I think our show keeps us on our toes in that way. And he's also kind of looking at the dynamics that we have with each other and watching us act. He kind of can change things and veer in different directions and push us more. So I kind of like the surprise element of it, because our show actually, weirdly, that is kind of spontaneous, but the words on the page, like, we cannot veer away. We do not ad lib. Everything is extremely, not rigid, but kind of, you know, we have to stay on book. And then the physicality or our emotion in the scene can kind of be, that's where we get the freedom. But the words and the memorization, it feels like a test every day, like learning the lines. It's a specific rhythm, and, you know, you'll miss a the and you're like, oh no, like, I gotta go again. So yeah, it's a real specific challenge.
Yeah, there's a rhythm to the language,
totally.
Right? And I'm sure also just some of the absurdity, those moments probably trip you up sometimes too.
They do. Well, yeah, also you can't stop laughing, like especially with scenes with Nick and I, he's so funny. Like,
yeah.
It's like you see, you know, a lip quiver, it's like, oh God, I'm gonna go. And like we bust up and like ruin takes a lot. But that is the fun of our set for sure. Yeah, I think, and also like, again, like the rhythm of comedy was something I had to learn, because I definitely have done more dramatic roles, you know, whatever that means. But this is, you know, these scripts, you read it and you're like, oh yeah, that's a joke. Like, that's a punchline. I have to hit that. And so it really, the first season, I was really learning. And I think the second season, all of us kind of realized what the tone was. And so we came back kind of raring to go. And especially me, I felt kind of like the most uninhibited I'd ever felt, and the least embarrassed, and kind of willing to try and willing to really expose myself, especially in like the comedy arena. I was not afraid to push it. So I learned a lot.
How does it, I know you talked a little about this before. How does it happen that you come back and you say, you know what, now I'm going to dive into this really dark and deep story that is the yeah. opposite of light and funny? And you didn't have much time in between, right? You dove right in, pretty much.
That is true. Yes. So from The Great season 2, I only had 2 weeks in between to go from The Great to The Girl from Plainville. Wow. So it was a complete 180 yeah. for sure. And I had been living in, you know, the great world for a while then, because it was the first season, and the second kind of happened pretty quickly after that. So, you know, The Girl from Plainville was a project that I knew was kind of looming. Like, I, especially during filming The Great, I knew that it was a project that I had signed on to do, but it's almost one of those things that you're like, oh gosh, it's that daunting thing in the back of your head that you're like nervous about and actually don't quite know what you're going to do with the character yet. And just that thing that I honestly, during The Great, I was really suppressing even thinking about Michelle. I mean, you don't have much time to think about anything else when you're doing The Great, except for what you're doing. But it was like those 2 weeks, I was like, gosh, I have to rest. But then I also have to try to figure out who Michelle Carter is, because, you know, I didn't speak to her. I knew basically what everyone else knew about her from the media and kind of the headline stories, and obviously the Esquire article that the show is based on, that Jesse Barron wrote, and Aaron Lee Carr's HBO documentary. I had watched those, and, you know, those were kind of, the public knew that a bit, but we had to dive in more. I mean, we have to do a complete show and try to figure out this character who, there's not a lot on her. There's a lot of photographs, and I mean, there are YouTube videos in court of her, you know, just sitting, but she never testifies or never speaks. So it's really from the ground up that you have to begin.
Yeah, and people pretty much know the salacious portions of the story. They don't really, they obviously haven't dived into the specifics of these people and who they were, and Michelle especially. Mm-hmm. A lot of sort of just surface understandings of who she was versus diving deeper into issues of mental health and, mm-hmm. and some of the things that Plainville dives into. Yeah. And I know you had a lot of conversations with Liz Hanna and the folks there, and sort of figuring out how to tackle that and how you were going to tackle Michelle.
Yeah, because I was even tentative to honestly sign on to the project, you know, when this came to me, just because I think this is a story that can really easily be sensationalized and romanticized just for to do a TV show. And, you know, we want people to watch it. And that is a, I was like, gosh, that is not the story that I want to tell, especially knowing that these families are alive and a young man's life was lost. And I really talked to everyone involved a lot of times before kind of saying yes. And ultimately, I also was able to be a producer on the show, which of course adds more of a responsibility, but I felt like having a part of that control could contribute to, you know, telling this story in a thoughtful way. And luckily, everyone on the entire team, we all felt the same in how we wanted to bring sensitivity to this and also kind of show the story from an unbiased approach. I think, you know, like you said, the media really, you know, they only shared a bit, is very one-dimensional on both sides. I mean, Michelle was like this black, they, you know, portrayed her as this black widow manipulator. And then, you know, Conrad was her victim, and he very much was a victim. But also at the same time, he was portrayed really one-dimensionally. All we knew about him was that he, you know, committed suicide, and we didn't know much about his backstory. So I think all of us wanted to dive into that and the world of technology, which I think we're all really trying to navigate. And back when the court case was happening, I mean, I didn't follow it intensely. I mean, I think I was 19, so I just graduated high school myself. But just hearing about these young people that are honestly kind of the first generation of seeing what the results of growing up with technology can do, and actually the horror side of that. Yeah. They're the first generation of this. So I think it's so intriguing and honestly really scary. But playing with that false intimacy, and, you know, you can be whoever you want to be over the phone. You can interpret emotions, you can say anything, you can create a whole other persona, which I think Michelle definitely did at times. You know, she lived in fantasy, which is something I can partly relate to as being an actor. I live in fantasy all the time. So I love the fantasy elements of the show. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is fantasy elements because, and I think something that they do so well that you guys have created so well is making these text messages come to life because a lot of people who have seen the documentary or have watched, you know, the news stories can talk about how they've read some of the messages, or you see them on the screen written. But having seeing you guys act them out together, you and Colton Ryan, yeah, who is incredible in this role, the seeing you guys kind of act those out together and almost in like a theatrical way is so fascinating. So that must have been something that was almost like fun for you to do in some scenes.
Yeah, it was a different. I'd never done that before on screen. I mean, part of it too, I was like, how are we going to show the texting? Because texting is not cinematic. Texting is not something that I want to watch, you know, really. I mean, something that we do all the time, every day. It's almost weirdly like watching people in masks in TV shows. I'm like, I don't want to see that.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's right. Like the same with being on the phone. I'm we know what that is. So, but obviously this is, you know, deemed the texting suicide case. I mean, so it's, you can't have this without the text. And I think using the device of bringing these texts to life to show the progression of their relationship, because one of the most fascinating things is that they only met a handful of times, and we did have access to read all of their text messages between each other, which is really haunting, but also quite like a normal teenage relationship, whatever normal, but there's silliness, there's, you know, secrecy, telling their deepest, darkest secrets. Like there's a real intimacy in these messages because that was their entire relationship. So that helped so much. And I think, you know, when Colton and I would do those scenes together, it, you know, normally when you have an acting partner, you're trying to always, you know, listen to what they're saying and pick up on their emotions in their eyes. And, you know, that's being connected. But these scenes were completely the opposite. Like they were about being completely disconnected and honestly interpreting our words or our emotions in a different way, or really not seeing each other. So there was kind of rules in place when we had those fantasies, like we couldn't touch. We had, you know, we would a lot of the time be playing opposite emotions and more disconnected, which was, I think, was a challenge, but it was interesting, you know? Yeah, he's so incredible. Like you said, he's so great. So we had a good time. As much of a good time as it was intense every day on set. But yeah, we still we were close, I guess, or supporting each other.
Yeah, he was telling me that he was singing show tunes in between and was like, I was keeping it light. And everyone was like, we're trying to film this really emotional scene. Like, maybe.
I know, he's such a, well, he's a big, you know, musical theater guy. I mean, and he got to show his pipes. Absolutely. We had a musical moment. So, I know, we can't get Colton Ryan without getting him to sing.
So, Elle, how much Glee did you watch growing up? Versus now, what kind of Glee fan were you?
I was not a hardcore Glee fan growing up. I definitely seen episodes, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't watch religiously like a lot of my friends did. So I had to revisit that. I've seen Fault in Our Stars before, but I watched it again before this and watched a lot of episodes of Glee. And that was honestly what kind of, I don't know, the light bulb went off when her fascination, I think, with pop culture and with celebrity and this YA world of, you know, as a teenager, you are trying to create your own narrative. Like, you're trying to figure out who you are. And like with me, like, I loved Grease growing up, like, was obsessed with Grease. And I totally tried to like create that. Like, the guy I dated in high school, I was like, I want the bad guy. I want to be the Sandy. Like, that's a little bit, but it's like,
were you Sandy?
Yeah, I was, you know, I totally was. And then, you know, she has a little edge at the end. Like, I was like, but there's something there that's like, I think we can, you know, a sliver of that understand to, I don't know, to relating to these stories and trying to be the star in your own version of that in your head. And I think, you know, obviously Michelle, or our Michelle that we created, you know, took that to another level, almost became an obsessive level. But also, I can't help but feel kind of, it's like my kind of heart breaks for her, because it's like the loneliness that she had. And especially, I remember filming the court scenes of when her so-called, she thinks, are her friends are like testifying against her and saying that, you know, we'd never wanted to hang out with her. And like that, oh man, that's like, you know, just the worst possible thing, especially at that age, you know, and what she must feel. So it's all, yeah, the Glee. I mean, I watched the Make You Feel My Love, Leah Michelle, her singing that. So many times I would record myself in my apartment doing every mannerism. So like when she closes her eyes on the certain word and when she tears up on that line and like when she puts her hand to her chest, like I wanted it to be exact, because that was when I read the pilot, it was a bit ago. And like, I was like, that scene, I was like, you know, sometimes you just know as an actor, like that's the scene. Like, I'm either going to be able to do it or not. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's just, you know, it was like, okay, I had to do my homework. So I watched that so many times, but I think it just sums up the show in a lot of ways, you know, of her, because a lot of people are like, whoa, like that's creepy. Tinge of like creepiness to it, but also real sadness, because watching someone in real time, she can't grieve herself. Like, she can't feel those emotions herself. So she has to watch someone else to emulate grief. Like, she's pretending to grieve for herself. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really layers of like meta.
I know.
It's so intense.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
It's very.
But it does remind you again, that's, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're that age, that's mm-hmm. exactly what you're doing. Like, mm-hmm. how am I supposed to act? How am I supposed to grieve? Like,
a lot of copying.
TV showed me how I'm supposed to. So I guess this is what I need to do.
Completely. So, yeah.
You keep mentioning sort of your version of Michelle.
Yeah.
You know, talk a little bit about that and sort of, you know, what your takeaway was. Sort of your feeling is now. What's you know, who is Michelle in your mind versus both your Michelle, but also the real Michelle?
Yeah. I mean, that's something, I mean, we talked about a lot, because obviously Patrick McManus and Liz Hanna were our showrunners, and they just so delicately, I think, fine to every character, is their journey so specific and it's so thought out. And I think you could feel, you know, they definitely had a lot of weight on their shoulders to try to get this as accurate and told in a responsible way. You know, I think, you know, you can't really, I can't, it's like cliche, it's like to say, to judge a character, I can't judge a character that I'm playing. You know, she made these choices. And so it's my job to try to understand how she did the things she ultimately did. And I don't have to agree with what she did. You know, she said some really horrible, horrible things, but I have to try to wrap my head around how she got there and can't judge her for that. And, you know, it's something that we talked about it a lot. I was nervous. I think I was nervous to, I'm trying, She's very, like, the teenage girl of her is very heightened. So there's the way it's written too is like high drama. Like I was worried. I'm like, are people going to think that I'm just overacting? There was a part of me that was like, gosh, I'm like, this scene is so dramatic. And I think that was the fun of calibrating it. And I would turn to them and be like, to Liz and Patrick, be like, is this okay? Like, is this too much? Like, and I think also in the editing room, I got to be there, which was, I love that side.
Being a producer has its
benefits. I know. I loved being in the editing room because there's so many different choices that you could make. I mean, with everyone, but kind of calibrating it to show that, you know, I think the audience really, we're not answering many questions. I think we're putting it all out on the table, and we're also not trying to overturn a verdict. I mean, she went to jail for involuntary manslaughter, and that is what happened. And I think especially like with the last episode, episode 8, it was a while where we were like, how are we going to end this? Because it's not neatly tied up. We're not trying to tell a new side. This is ultimately what happened. But I do think we kind of call it the eternal sunshine, like fantasy sequence of when you kind of go inside Michelle's mind and basically like the limbo that she's living in. That for me, I think it was a good way to show that ultimately she has to accept the guilt that she's guilty of what she's done and kind of face what she did head on. And so, gosh, yeah, it's hard to know, you know, what she thinks but obviously, you know, Conrad's life, he's gone. And I think Lynn too is really out there really advocating for her son. And I think this show is also it's a real cautionary tale of if you see signs or, you know, you have to get help and really not do what she did. Yeah. No.
I'm curious about the producer side of you going forward. Is that something now you're like, oh, I got a taste of it. I just want to do more.
Yeah, I do love it. I really do. I think also like growing up, because I, you know, was a young actor or whatever. But when you're on sets from such a young age, you start to feel, or at least I did, like start to feel like, what is everyone else doing? Like, how does this work? Like, what are the cogs in the wheel? Like, I want to be a part of that. I want more. So there is a part of me that's happy that I get to, you know, build things kind of from more of the beginning and watch everything get put together. And, you know, the first season of The Great was really when I got to be a producer and, you know, we pitched that out and I got to see that side and be in rooms that I normally wouldn't be in. And my confidence has grown a lot. I think all the showrunners would say now that I'm very opinionated. Like, but I think, you know, I've learned to not be as scared and be a bit more outspoken about stuff. And yeah, hope to direct one day. I'm sure a lot of people say that. We'll see. One day.
How about episode of The Great?
I know. You know, I've thought about that, but I think it would have to be an episode that Catherine's not in. Like, I don't know if I could direct that
yourself.
Show and be, yeah.
You do that classic thing where you're like behind the camera, then you race in front, you're in costume, and then go behind again.
I know. I watched because I was in Live By Night with Ben Affleck and he was in it and he was directing. And so I saw that and he would have to like cut himself. Like it's like sustained, he'd be like, and cut. And I'm like, in a scene. It's like, this is nuts. You have to put on so many hats. Yeah. Who knows?
So on The Great, I don't know how much you can sort of hint at season 3, but obviously things end, you know, as we
We call it like the graduate ending of season 2. Like that's what Tony kept saying, because they're both like, what do we do now, right. You know?
Right. So things are obviously precarious between those two. But moving on, what do you think we should expect whenever we get back to season 3, which...
Yeah, hopefully, soon. I think they, you know, we've never truly seen these two living as like a married couple. They've always had a lot of complications. Catherine has mostly also been really suppressing her feelings and not just kind of saying it like it is, which is she's in love with the guy, you know. And now they have this child together. And I think, you know, they're going to try out marriage for a bit and see how that goes for them. All while, you know, Catherine's still trying to figure out if she is a capable ruler. I think like what I love about her so much is that she, you know, she has a giant ego, which is really fun to play. You know, she kind of loves hearing herself talk and making these rousing speeches with a lot of ideas that are fantastic ideas and very progressive ideas, which, you know, the the real Catherine the Great, she did. But also, you know, a country's not going to change overnight. And I think Catherine, she wants to see results. And, you know, it's not always like that. So I'm also excited. Nick and I would talk about this too. Like, I think Catherine is a lot like Peter. And I think that's why she kind of resents him, because he's the only person who truly kind of sees her and knows the shoes that she's in and the pressures that she's under. And I know there would be times where Nick's like, oh, you're acting like me a little bit. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of true. I don't know. She can be a tyrant at times. Yeah. she's now at the end of the season too. Yeah, she's killed a man. So, you know, she's so against bloodshed, but she had to kill someone.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah, it
right?
happens.
Huzzah.
Yeah, huzzah. That's right.
So we have our rapid fire six questions for you now.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So we'll learn a little bit more about Elle.
Okay.
Well, first off, this is the question that we may have already asked you, but mm-hmm. the question that people ask you the most.
Oh, the question that people ask me the most. That's interesting. You guys, I don't think you have asked me. It's normally... used to be like, are you Dakota Fanning? Yeah, that's what it used to be all the time.
That would have been funny if that was our first question.
I know. And honestly, it sometimes still is. Like, I've gotten that, like, you know, on the streets, like fans on the street, like, oh, are you Dakota Fanning? No, I'm her sister.
So. Close.
Yeah, close. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, 1 degree of separation. Yeah, that's the one.
I like it. The TV show in history that you wish you were a part of.
Ooh, that's really good. TV show in history. God, that's good. What do I love?
Yeah, if you could go back in time and join the cast of some great
Friends
show.
Is kind of fun, right? I always related to Phoebe. I would be a Phoebe for sure if I was in Friends.
Well, if they do the remake.
I know. I also watched Girls recently and I had never seen it. And I think I'm like the perfect age to watch it because they're in the season one. I just turned 24 and they're like 23 starting
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
I loved it. I like, yes, but I would want to be Adam Driver. He's so good. Yeah. If I could play him in that show, he's wild. I mean, he's amazing.
Yeah.
But I'm like, he's so good in that show.
That
so
would, good. By the way, like a gender swapped girl.
Really be interesting.
Oh, so good.
Right? Yeah. And I'm the crazy boyfriend.
Right. Yeah. All right. I like it. What would people be surprised that you watch? Speaking of TV, like your guilty pleasure.
Ooh. I still watch American Idol.
Wow.
I'm like, isn't
you're the
that
one.
Funny? I know. I watch. Yeah, I'm the one. I do. I know. I still am like holding on. They had Disney Week last week. So. Yeah.
Love the synergy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
That's a surprise.
I would ask if you had a favorite this season, but I don't know who any of the contestants are.
You could
are.
Make up a name.
I know.
Have no
yeah,
idea.
Exactly. There's a lot of good ones. Christian's really good. You know,
yeah. Christian's great. Yeah,
great.
Love Christian.
Big fan.
All right, we'll go with Christian.
I just remember like calling in, like when I was young.
Yeah.
Like I would,
yeah.
I totally called
Same.
In, be like over and over and over again.
Do you have a favorite Loved idol of all time?
Favorite? Oh, I love Fantasia.
Yeah.
I remember really calling in for her
yeah.
a lot. That's like a memory. I don't know.
Yeah.
Writing them down, like what's the number? What's the number? You know, so different. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So what hobby would you be doing if you didn't have your day job? What's the hobby that you wish you had more time to pursue?
A hobby. That's interesting. I love, like, I've always loved miniatures. So, like, if I could have, like, Toni Collette's job in Hereditary, like, making, like, a dollhouse, I would
yeah.
do that. Wow. Very obscure. But I've always, like, I remember, like, my first, like, internet memory is going on like eBay sites or like they used to have like, I don't even think they have these sites anymore, but it was like miniatures.com and like you would see like tiny little Wonder Bread, like perfect. You're just
yeah.
like, oh my God, this looks so realistic. I love it. So yeah, I had a lot of dollhouses growing up. So super weird, but yeah, I wish I had more time for my miniatures.
Yeah, gotta bring that back.
It's fascinating.
You see that every once in a while.
Yeah.
I know there's some,
but it is true, right? Like Toni Collette, she's like a
yeah.
she makes like she's like a, I guess she's an artist and making like yeah,
right.
hopefully a little less
haunted.
Like, yeah, like I don't want to crawl on the walls, but
but the happy part of that.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
The Wonder Bread.
Yeah, the Wonder Bread.
So, what's the food you can cook? What's your? Do you have
Ooh.
A dish that's like your signature dish?
I love to cook, so I make a great eggplant parm, like a really good eggplant parm. A lot of Italian, like I've over the quarantine, I made like, you know, hand rolled pasta, and like, I didn't even have a pasta maker. So I was like, all right, let's just like YouTube, let's go. Like you and me, and like rolling out. I mean, you have to like use your muscles to get it really thin and make good like pasta sauce. I can do that well. I also made eclairs. Yeah, that was with the choux pastry. And yeah, so I do like to cook. My sister's more of the baker though, because she's super precise. Like my baking goods always turn out terribly because I'm like the crazy chef, you know, like woo, little dash of this. Like you can't do that with baking. So yeah, I don't call cake. Like I'm not good at cakes, yeah. But yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
That's perfect because you can do dinner, she can do dessert.
And that's what we do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we make Christmas Eve dinner, so.
Well, you know, if this acting thing doesn't work out, yeah. The two of you could just sort of get into business.
Sure, cooking, Food baking Network, show, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And finally, this is always a dangerous question to ask because you're so busy working. I don't know how much time you actually have to watch TV on the air right now, but if there's something that you watch this year that you're rooting for in Emmy season that really stuck with you or clicked with you.
I know. I mean, the funny thing is I watch a lot of TV and then these things come to me and I'm like, I like blank. I'm like, oh no. God, what do I watch? What have I seen? I mean, The Dropout is Liz Hannah, so, you know, she's in The Family.
That counts.
That's
Dropout, totally that's fantastic.
You know, that really counts. Like Another Blonde, or like Big Blue Eyes. Like, you know, she could be a Fanning for sure.
Elizabeth Holmes could be a fan.
Yeah.
I think we leave it right there.
There
I love it. Well, Elle, congratulations on being Hulu's MVP.
Thank you.
I think they should give you a trophy or something.
They're giving me comments, you know. I got that.
Just
words
give
of affirmation.
Self-affirmation. Yeah, that's great. You go, girl. Yes, queen.
Exactly.
That's The Girl from Plainville and the great star, Elle Fanning. Both shows are now streaming on Hulu. After the break, Pachinko showrunner Sue Hugh. From Los Angeles, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It's the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. Apple TV Plus's epic drama Pachinko examines the history of ethnic Korean inhabitants of Japan through the lens of Sunja, a fish merchant born in Korea during Japanese colonial rule. She's forced to immigrate to Japan after becoming pregnant out of wedlock. The original novel by Min Jin Lee traces Sunja's life chronologically, split into three linear parts. But in adapting that story to television, showrunner and executive producer Sue Hugh chose to blow up that structure and instead follow two different timelines. One in the 1920s, when Sunja is a young woman played by Min Ha Kim, and one set in 1989, when Sunja is an elderly woman played by Yeo Jung Yoon. Every episode crisscrosses between these time periods, mostly keeping to the text of the original novel while telling the story in a completely different way. I recently spoke with Sue Hugh about the origins of the series, the difficulty of shooting the show, especially during the pandemic, and whether it will eventually be more widely seen in Japan. I began by asking her how gratifying the reaction to Pachinko has been for her.
I had no idea how the show was going to do, not just critically, but this show just feels like such a weird anomaly and a miracle in every way that I really, really had no idea. But in the past few months since the show has been released, I've had so many people come up to me and say, oh, this show reminded me of my grandmother, or this show reminded me of, you know, my grandfather, or this relative that I never quite knew, but I always heard her story. this really broke open sort of the biography from people, if that makes sense. People would just get really emotional and sincere. And that was when I knew there's something, this show is tapping into something. The thing that made me respond to this story, it's being communicated to everyone else, which is, that's gratifying.
Yeah. And I think something also that I've heard from a lot of people is sort of just finally understanding and being educated about the sort of the plight of Korean immigrants to Japan, especially in the early part of the 20th century, and the discrimination and the struggles that they faced, you know, both through the occupation in Korea, but then also when immigrating to Japan. And a lot of that as sort of, I think, unfamiliar to most people, including people from Japan. A friend of mine who grew up in Japan was telling me that she watched Pachinko and she was like, I really had no idea. I had no idea. And that must also be stunning to hear that from people who even grew up there and didn't understand sort of the situation.
Yeah. We live in very strange times. And what I mean by that is the past is being buried. And it feels like Pachinko is a fiction show. It is not a documentary. And I think it's important to say, like, I never want to ever people think this is true life.
Yeah.
But if this show can help just a little bit excavate stories, the true history, and as your friend said, people be aware of one's past, I think then I would feel like we did some good in this world. I knew the very bare bones of the Zainichi experience, but digging into the research of this show, my mind was I was blown away by how big the story was and how utterly erased it's become.
Yeah. And so obviously, like you said, it's not a documentary, but, you know, nonetheless, I know you talked to a lot of people and did a lot of research, like you said, to at least get a better understanding and really reflect, you know, some of the truth of what happened. And so, you know, talk a little bit more about how important that was for you and what you hope people will take away and maybe, you know, go and you know, do their own research or sort of, you know, educate themselves a little bit more.
I mean, the research component of the show took about a year, roughly a year. And one of the reasons why was because the show spans about over 80 years. And once you decide to cross-cut time periods, I didn't have the luxury of saying, oh, I'll learn about that season two. Because all the characters have lived through all 80 years, I had to really break down the entire history from the get-go, from season one. And, you know, not only just diving into what happened in colonial years, but I had to figure out what happened in World War II. Because when we meet Sunja in our so-called present day, the older Sunja, she's lived through World War II. She's lived through the Korean War. She's lived through, and you're just like, ah, that character won't ever feel real if I don't know her entire biography. And so talking to just consultants and historians who are experts, not just on like specific parts of the Zainichi history, but food historians, costume historians, we had historians on everything from like media historians, like what were people watching in the 1980s? And first of all, I love that there's someone who like specializes like specifically in 1980s Japanese television. You're like, that is your job? That's amazing. But that was just really important, helping to flesh out the real world of the show. Because I feel like for me, my bullshit radar goes off when I'm like, I don't quite buy it. If you're doing a period show, I really want to be immersed in it and fall into it and make it as visceral as possible. So really those details help.
Yeah, especially because there are obviously a lot of people lived through the 80s, both in Japan and also, I mean, they remember the death of Hirohito back in the day and, you know, the one-sided reaction there. So you're also dealing with an audience that sort of, they know some things, they don't know other things. And so, but yeah, the ambition of Pachinko, I think is fascinating to me because there's a lot to stuff into this when you talk about jumping from the different eras and playing with different versions of these characters, both in their youth and also older. How do you even start to sort of craft something like this? What was the process like in the beginning to kind of map out, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to jump from different eras. This is how we're going to take this original book and turn it into a series. That seems daunting to me.
You know, it is. It's like that. It's the problem with the white page, the blank white page, right? When you stare at the, and you just need to type in something so you don't have blankness staring at you. I always start off by knowing what I don't want to do or what I don't want the show to be. Sometimes that's much more helpful to me than determining what a show is from the beginning, if that makes sense. So I knew at the beginning that I did not want to do masterpiece theater. And what I mean by that is I didn't want the language of this show to feel like you're watching a book come to life. And by the way, I love masterpiece theater. I love Jane Austen. I love all those adaptations. But especially because this was a history, as you said, that so many people didn't know, it had to feel lived in. So that was the one thing. It's like, this show has to feel not period, if that makes sense. We had to just really erase all those boundaries. Two, I knew that if I told this story chronological, it wouldn't sort of the thesis statements that I wanted to explore until much later in the season and a series. Meaning to me, the big, big questions don't even get posed until season four about what does generational trauma mean? How does one generation affect the other? What does the burdens of our forefathers put upon us or their sacrifices? If I told it chronologically, that none of those questions would even be scratched in the first season, right? Because you're really watching a coming of age story the first season. And in this climate of TV where we have so much great television and too much out there, you have to just go for broke right away and really start with what do I want to say in this show? And for me and my interest, it was the cross-cutting of time periods.
Yeah, and in some ways you're right in that there's the easier entry point in having sort of a, you know, modern day being the late 80s, but still sort of modern day to some degree is such a easier entry point, especially for young people tuning in to watch and slowly start to think about the generational issues that, you know, even the character isn't thinking about at first. He's just traveling to make a deal and try to, you know, prove his lot in life, not even thinking about what it all means from a larger perspective. So there's all of that. And then there's also just how do you tell the story? And this is where talking about, you know, being multilingual and deciding how to figure out the color coding, the closed captioning to denote different languages and sort of, you know, how was that going to be shown on screen? What were some of those conversations like in just figuring out logistically how this was going to work?
Well, I have to give Apple a lot of credit from the very beginning. They didn't bat an eye when we said this show has to be told in the native languages that characters spoke in. And that shows you really how far we've come, right? Like that conversation 5 years ago, this show would all have been all in English. Can't imagine anyone who would have made this show in Korean and Japanese. But once you get to the Korean and Japanese and you're watching the characters speak, we knew we had to color code. I didn't quite know what the colors was going to be. But in the script, it's written out when they switch languages, even within sentences. So it'll be like Solomon says, these words in Japanese, these words in Korean, these words in Japanese. So just looking at the script, we color coded them so that the actors can read it really easily. And it just felt like this very intuitive, easy way to get that.
No, and I think you pick it up really relatively fast. I think you're right. Even 10 years ago, there still was a barrier to entry for closed captioning and for subtitles. But we're really living in an age now where people are embracing them, and it's a good time finally to be able to tell these stories. So
yeah.
So there's that. And then there's also, you know, going back to sort of the jumps, you know, there is sort of a nice dance that you start to really get into the groove, like as you're watching episode 2, episode 3, episode 4, where you really start to, you feel the rhythm of when the show jumps back in time to the 30s and then to the 80s. And a lot of that's in editing, I know, but, you know, sort of what were your ideas and, you know, how often you were going to make those jumps and how those would look and how in after a while it becomes so organic, you just sort of, you know, it feels natural.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that. In the script, you know, there's a lot of cross-cutting in the script as a template. But then once you get to the editing room, you throw it all out. And really the mandate, sort of what dictated a cut, was when do we feel something? If you're going from one time period to another and it just feels academic, right? Like you match cuts, for example. Match cuts are really satisfying the first time or second time you do it in an episode. They start to lose its power. So constantly asking ourselves, like, when are we craving to jump back and forth? What is that dialogue that we're setting up? And trying to use all those editing toolboxes. Is this a hard cut here? Is this a very long, long, long dissolve so that we almost feel like the two time periods are ghosts over one another? Is it a music dissolve, is just in terms of editing of the show was long. I mean, I think it's by far the longest post-process I've ever had on a TV show. And I just think it's because we had to really try and experiment through all of that. Like, I think the number of cuts that we did, there were a lot of cuts. Yeah.
Well, I know that's necessary. And also, you know, just from a production standpoint, and I know you've probably been asked this a lot, but I'm curious how it was shot in terms of, did you shoot all of the 30s stuff first and then the 80s stuff, or how was the shot?
That would have been really nice if we could have done that. It would have been a much more saner approach. So because we shot in two countries, we had to shoot Korea all out. Mm-hmm. And then we moved over to Vancouver and shot all of Vancouver. And when I think about what Kay and Justin had to go through, pretty much they each shot an 8-hour movie at the same time with two sets running often. So it would be the actors would go from 1931 to 1935, from Osaka to Busan, all on the same day. You know, the production was such a challenge and such a puzzle that we really had to just schedule based on what locations were available, how many hours of day we had for an outdoor scene. So it didn't really provide the most elegant or sane model.
You got to do what you got to do. Was there anything in particular that you remember that was sort of a challenge that maybe you couldn't figure out for a while that you finally cracked, like a eureka moment, an aha moment when you realize, oh, okay, we could do it this way?
I don't know if it's a eureka moment, but there's definitely so many moments when it felt bearable, manageable. You know, when we first got to Korea and I saw, you know, even in the canteen, we had so many translators on this show. Like when I think about, I had a translator, just to have a simple conversation, why are there two translators for this one conversation? And when this show first began shooting, I was like, we're never going to finish. Everything took twice as long, right? Because everything had to be translated. Yeah. Every conversation with all actors, all the conversation with the directors. But then I think what was really inspiring, sort of instead of the eureka moment, it was the exhale moment, what I call, is I remember when we were leaving Korea, about to go to Vancouver. In those final days, people were getting really emotional about it ending in Korea, you know, and there was such a shorthand in communicating. And these people who just started off the show, not speaking the same language, a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of quibbles. At the end, they just did hand gestures. And I thought that was just incredibly, incredibly powerful to see that. I think I teared up a little bit. We were supposed to shoot in Japan. We did only the plate shoots in Japan. We couldn't get in because of COVID. So that was probably the biggest puzzle of how do we do Japan?
Yeah. And so that's where Vancouver came in.
We always knew we were going to do sets in Vancouver, but we were supposed to do Korea, Japan, and Vancouver. So all the stuff that we were supposed to shoot in Vancouver, then we had to split between Korea and Vancouver.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, we haven't even talked about COVID. Let's add that on top of all the other challenges, you know, and in shooting this and making it look natural. I know everyone's been struggling with this over the past 2 years, but how did you find that sort of, you know, adjustment and shooting under these protocols, especially internationally?
You know, it's a huge testament to our production team in the sense that the priority was always to keep everyone safe. But can I tell you, you know, having all of us with COVID, it really made me more grateful to shoot, if that makes sense. I think if I hadn't, because we weren't even sure we were going to shoot. So by the time we got to Korea, it felt like this gift that we really just needed to honor, because so many shows did shut down.
And so it sounds like things worked out okay. No major.
We didn't. You know, we were very fortunate. We had no shutdowns. Korea, obviously, they had their act. It was very impressive just how the country handled COVID with the contact tracing. And then when we got to Vancouver, we were a bubble, so we really did protect ourselves.
That's cool. That's good to hear. Hopefully as you, what's the plan now to get back into production? What's the,
There was no break. I had to jump into the season 2 writer's room, and it's always been conceived as 4 seasons. So season 2, which then follow the second generation, we will shoot sometime early next year. And
TBD on actual, the camera start rolling again sometime Sometime next year, hopefully things will be a little more under control COVID-wise then. And is the hope to maybe then shoot in Japan or what's...
Yeah, I think Japan is a crucial part of this production. So we really would, I'm very eager to get in there.
Yeah,
and nervous because, you know, we're going in with the best intentions. So
I wanted to ask you about Japan real quick, because I've heard that the show isn't as well known in Japan, that perhaps it hasn't been promoted as much, or it's just, you know, there still are some lingering, you know, obviously, I don't know, political issues. I don't know how to describe it, but clearly a show that probably hasn't been talked about or seen or heard about as much in Japan. And what are your thoughts on that and concerns or maybe disappointments that not as many people have heard or seen about the show there?
And that's what's great about being on a streamer is we're there forever, right? And what's interesting about Japan really was the great unknown. Were they going to watch the show? Were they going to boycott the show? Were they going to... There were best case scenarios and worst case scenarios. And I think what the reality was ended up being somewhere in the middle, right? You know, Apple TV Plus launched in Asia recently. And so I think Japan is definitely still catching up and to the platform. But I have to believe, you know, knowing the intentions that went behind what we did in season one and going forward, that I have to believe that a Japanese audience will find this show. And I have to believe that they will see that this show is not about casting heroes and villains. You know, it really isn't. But at the same time, it's not going to blink. It's not going to turn away from what really happened. And I hope that the integrity of the storytelling is the thing that convinces people that we're worth watching in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, this is a long tail and there'll be more seasons as well. So eventually, hopefully it'll resonate there as well. Real quick, your cast. I mean, it's an amazing cast, you know, with some familiar faces to American audiences and some new faces for us who I know are superstars elsewhere. But, you know, what was that casting process like for you?
It was so long. It felt so, so long. First of all, I realized, why did I write so many characters to cast? Because I had to cast like 600 and some actors, right? And then because of all the multiple languages, it was such an interesting process. Like, I don't even know Japanese, and how do you evaluate a performance? And the most reassuring thing was knowing that emotions do transcend language. As cheesy as it sounds, it was like, oh, totally. I'm crying right now and I don't know a word you just said. So that was really reassuring. It was because especially the Korean model of casting was so different from the US American model that I'm used to. There was a learning curve on both parts, on my part, on Korea's part. But end of the day, I think I'm so glad we went through that process. I think the cast that we got and put together, it's the dream cast.
Not bad having Yoo Jung-yoon there too, especially after her Oscar win. I don't know what the timing was like. If you had
already cast her before the Oscar.
Oh, so you're watching the Oscars and you're like,
yes, yeah,
we're golden.
I know.
Too good to be true. She's so fantastic. So maybe we'll keep getting her more awards. Also, like Jimmy Simpson, like, did he learn Japanese? Like,
Jimmy did not know Japanese at all, but he did learn it. He was such a good, and I loved, he'd be like, I feel like I'm getting too good at Japanese because, you know, Tom's only been here 2 years. It was so, I was like, I love Jimmy.
The other thing that I so love, I never fast forward over the opening credits.
Yeah.
And I know you hear about that a lot too. It's just such a...
I love it. Yeah.
Joyful opening. I just love them dancing in the pachinko parlor. Just there's something so cool about how that it's cut and seeing all the characters. Just it's so fun. Where did that come from? That idea for that opener?
Well, I write title sequences into the script. And obviously at first when I was writing the title sequence, I almost threw it out, that version, because it was like, oh gosh, that's very lame. The show is called Pachinko. To do a title sequence in a pachinko parlor, like,
too on the nose.
I was like, is this going to be amateur hour? And then I was like, wait a minute, these pachinko parlors are pretty amazing. They're great. They just, the metaphor of the pachinko parlor, but also the visual imagery of the pachinko parlor. So like, let's just go for it. You know, it was a different song that was written in the script, which a song that we couldn't end up affording in the end. And I'm so glad, because I can't imagine a different song than what we have now.
Yeah. What was the song, the original song?
It was a Rolling Stones song, Out of Time. And it has that same poppy feel, but the lyrics are darker, that song, mm-hmm. Out of Time. And I'm glad that we went for more of the joyful version.
Yeah, yeah. Rolling Stones, that's expensive.
Yes. So apparently they're doing very well for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it is Apple, right? I mean, they've got, don't they have Apple Music deals? Who knows? But that's still cool. And that song works great. And it is sort of nice to see some of that joy also in because there are some, you know, obviously really dramatic moments on the show, really joyful moments. And to see that in the opening credits is sort of a nice balance too. So
I'm so glad. Thank you. I'm so happy that people are responding to it.
Yeah. So now on to season two, but how's everything else going? I know you've got a lot of plates spinning. What's sort of keeping you busy right now?
Well, right now I have two rooms. I have the Pachinko room and then I have the White Darkness room, which is based on a David Graham book and New Yorker article that Tom Hiddleston was starring. We'll shoot that next year as well. And on surface, Pachinko and the White Darkness seem almost like polar opposite stories. People are like, your brain must be sort of fritzing based on like to go from one room to the next that are just different stories. It's like, no, I mean, they're both stories about two indomitable people, right? You have the Singers of the world and you have the Henry Worsley of the world. The White Darkness is a true story about this man, Henry Worsley, who was a towering, amazing, amazing human being. When I think about that, I get paid to make stories of exceptional people, right? It's a privilege.
That's Sue Hugh, showrunner and executive producer of Pachinko, now streaming on Apple TV+. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode, and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Emmy predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Emily Longaretta, and Clayton Davis, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.